Genesis 31:38-32:32, the 32nd talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on November 10, 2002 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at the last part of Genesis chapter 31 and then chapter 32. Now, whoever wrote Genesis didn't divide this up neatly for 1 hour talks. The dividing lines are not coming as well as conveniently as would be nice. We left off last time when Jacob had been confronted by Laban. Now, let me rehearse this just very briefly, what's happened. Jacob went to Haran. He worked for 14 years for his two wives, Leah and Rachel. And then he worked an additional 6 years for Laban, their father, in exchange for accumulating some flocks. At the end of those 20 years, Jacob decided that things had become tense between him and Laban, and it was time for him to return back to the land where he had come from, back to Palestine. So he waited for an opportunity when Laban was away shearing the sheep and was a three-day journey away from where Jacob was. Jacob packed up all of his belongings, all of his wives, his children, all of his flocks, and they took off. Laban, after he found out that they had departed, he came running after them with a small army and caught up with Jacob and was clearly very upset by Jacob's sudden departure and the manner of the departure. And and seemed to have had a lot of energy and some anger. But God appeared to Laban the night before and said, "Don't touch Jacob." So Laban approaches Jacob a little bit chastened. He's angry, but he is restrained because God has spoken to him. And he accuses Jacob of essentially two things. One, the way you left was not good. You snuck away with my daughters and my grandchildren, and that's not right. I didn't get a chance to say goodbye to them properly. And to that, Jacob's response was, I did that because I was afraid if I didn't, that you wouldn't let us go. So I had to do it that way. The other charge was, you've stolen the idols. You stole my household idols. And that was the one that Laban was still insistent upon. And so Jacob says, "We didn't steal them. And you can look everywhere, but we didn't steal those, and we didn't steal anything of yours. Everything we have is ours." So Laban looks through everything. He doesn't find it. And although Jacob did not know it, Rachel had indeed stolen the idols, but she had hidden them, and Laban did not find them. So the search is over, and Jacob then confronts Laban and says, "You know, a lot of bitterness kind of spills out." And he says, "You've done me wrong for 20 years. And this is just kind of the icing on the cake. You have thought ill, you have treated me poorly, you've ripped me off, and now you suspect me of having stolen your idols. And so Jacob just lets out all this stuff that he has harbored against Laban over a number of years. Laban doesn't really have a response other than he wants to find some kind of peace between him and Jacob. And that's what we see in the last part of chapter 31 is the arrangement that they come up with. So starting in verse 43 to the end of the chapter. Then Laban answered and said to Jacob, "The daughters are my daughters, and the children are my children, and the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these my daughters, or to their children whom they have borne? So now, come, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me." Then Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. And Jacob said to his kinsmen, "Gather stones." So they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there by the heap. Now Laban called it Jegar Sehadutha, but Jacob called it Galeed. And Laban said, "This heap is a witness between you and me this day." Therefore it was named Galeed and Mizpah, for he said, "May the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent one from the other. If you mistreat my daughters, or if you take wives besides my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me." And Laban said to Jacob, "Behold this heap, and behold this the pillar which I have set between you and me. This heap is a witness, and the pillar is a witness, that I will not pass by this heap to you for harm, and you will not pass by this heap and this pillar to me for harm. The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us." So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Then Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain and called his kinsmen to the meal. And they ate the meal and spent the night on the mountain. And early in the morning, Laban arose and kissed his sons and his daughters and blessed them. Then Laban departed and returned to his place. Now, Laban decides that he needs to make a covenant with Jacob, just as you'll recall back, the Philistines made a covenant both with Abraham and with Isaac, because what they recognized was, these are men that are blessed by God, and we can't have them around us. They didn't want them around, but we don't want them against us. We want them on our side. We want a peace treaty with them because they are indeed blessed by God. And here's a similar situation where Laban, he definitely doesn't want Jacob on his bad side. He wants Jacob on his side. He wants a peace treaty between them. Now, it starts out with, "The daughters are my daughters, and the children are my children, and the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine." Laban's having a difficult time letting go of this stuff, because there's a sense in which, yes, they're his daughters, but they're also Jacob's wives. It's true they are his grandchildren, but they are Jacob's children. And the flocks, it's true that they had come originally from Laban, but Jacob had earned them. So Laban is having trouble letting go of these things. He's having difficulty adjusting to the realities of the situation and realizing that Jacob has become a separate family with his own wives, his own children, and his own flocks. But on the one hand, that's the case. On the other hand, he recognizes that, in fact, this is a separate family. Not only is it a separate family, but there's a sense in which Jacob has become a separate people. And what's happening here is a covenant between two separate peoples. And this is a recognition of that fact. They erect a stone. That's what Jacob had done at Bethel when God had appeared to Bethel there. He erects the large stone, and they make a pile of stones. They all pick up stones and stick them up in a pile, and that pile is to serve as a witness to this agreement that's being made. Laban names it in Aramaic. He names it it means the heap of witness. He names it a heap of witness in Aramaic. Jacob then names it the same thing, but in Hebrew. So we've got two peoples, two languages that are being exhibited here. The terms of the agreement, the heaviest terms are on Jacob. He is obligated to take good care of the wives. These are the daughters of Laban, and not to marry any other wives. But other than that, Jacob and Laban are both agreeing that they will not cross this spot to do harm to the other person. So beyond this spot, you don't go with arms. Then Jacob offers a sacrifice, and they all eat together. Eating is one of the ways that you seal this kind of agreement. So the agreement is done. Jacob has agreed to this peace treaty that Laban has forged. And there's a sense in which things are on good terms. Things are resolved. But I think it's clear that things are not quite resolved in another sense. Because if you notice, it says, when Laban leaves, he kissed his sons and his daughters and blessed them. Then Laban departed and returned to his place. He doesn't kiss Jacob. He had kissed Jacob when Jacob first arrived in Haran, but he doesn't kiss Jacob here on the departure. Furthermore, if you look through this text, in this whole section, Jacob does not say another word directly to Laban. So there's a tension that remains there. Formally, things are fine, but interpersonally between Laban and Jacob, there continues to be tension. So what has happened is this agreement has basically sealed the fact, has made clear the fact that Jacob's family is now a separate people. It is a separate people with its own language and with its own place. On the other side of this pile of rocks is Jacob's place. And it's a place that now there's no more going back. Jacob can't think in terms of, if things go bad now, I'll just go back to Haran. That's not an option. Clearly things are too strained for him to go back. They won't be sending sons back to marry daughters from Haran anymore. That relationship has been severed and won't be restored. So he can't go back. He has to go forward. And going forward means one way or another he's going to have to reconcile with Esau, because that's where he's going to. Okay, let's read the next section, chapter 32, 1 through 12. Now as Jacob went on his way, the angels of God met him. And Jacob said when he saw them, "This is God's camp." So he named that place Mahanaim. Then Jacob sent messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. He also commanded them, saying, "Thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now, and I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and male and female servants, and I have sent to tell my lord that I may find favor in your sight." And the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, "We came to your brother Esau, and furthermore he is coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him." Then Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people who were with him, and the flocks and the herds and the camels, into two companies. For he said, if Esau comes to the one company and attacks it, then the company which is left will escape. And Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham, and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, who did say to me, return to your country and to your relatives, and I will prosper you. I am unworthy of all the loving kindness and of all the faithfulness which thou hast shown to thy servant. For with my staff only I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two companies. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me, the mothers, with the children. For thou didst say, I will surely prosper you, and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. Remember back and put yourself in the shoes of Jacob. Jacob had left. Remember, Jacob left under unfortunate circumstances. Jacob had just ripped off his brother, had deceived him and ripped him off. And his brother threatened to kill him as soon as Isaac had died. So at the urging of his mother, Jacob fled and went to Haran. And the original plan was, you go to Haran, and in a few days, when Esau has calmed down, I will call you back. Well, he was gone for 20 years, and apparently no word from his mother. So what is Jacob to think with respect to Esau? What's going on in Esau's mind? And I think we all know enough about human nature to realize that Esau could have gone two different directions here. It could be that for 20 years, he's been building up bitterness. If that's the case, Esau could be a time bomb. I mean, it could be horrendous. The other possibility is Esau has come to terms with what has happened and has let go of that bitterness. Jacob doesn't know what's happened. It's been 20 years of silence, for all we know. I mean, there's no indication that he has heard any word from his family. So he is going back, and he's facing this unknown, but the potential that his brother is furious with him. But if he's going to go back to the land, he has to come to terms with his brother one way or another. So that's what Jacob is facing. Now, it's not clear to me exactly what Jacob is thinking with respect to the route that he chooses. I don't know all of the circumstances at the time of Jacob, but I know later in history that it was possible to go from Gilead to Bethel without going as far south on the east side of the Jordan as Jacob chooses to do. It appears to me that Jacob has gone out of his way to go down towards his brother because I think he wants to reconcile with his brother before then he crosses over into Palestine proper. So I think Jacob has consciously chosen this route. He wants to reconcile with Esau. But this is a very scary thing. And it's scary for two reasons. One, he knows that his brother is he's a hunter. He's an outdoorsman. He's probably capable of considerable violence. So he knows his brother, and he knows there's the potential for danger. The other thing is, I think Jacob is dealing with his own conscience. And that's just compounding the problem. So there's a great deal of apprehension on his part as he approaches the territory where Esau is living. God is very merciful at this particular point. As he moves on from Gilead down further south, he sees angels. And the angels, they don't say anything to him. He doesn't say anything to them. He just sees them. And because he sees them, it's like he sees them as another camp. His group is one camp, and he sees the angels as another camp. So he names the place Two Camps. Nothing is said, but there is a certain amount of reassurance that comes to Jacob that God is in control of things. God is with him. It's just merely their presence that is a certain amount of reassurance. Jacob then begins to take some actions to set up his reunification with Esau, his meeting with Esau. He sends out some messengers to Esau that are going to take a message to him. And the author says, then Jacob sent messengers before him to his brother Esau in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. It's interesting because the words that he has chosen, Seir means hairy. And if you'll recall, Esau was a hairy man. And one of the deceptions involved the hairiness of Esau. And he's in the country of Edom. If you'll recall, just before the incident in which Jacob conned his brother out of the birthright for a bowl of soup, it referred to Esau as a man of the country. And Edom means red. Esau was red, and the soup that he sold the birthright for was red. So there's a sense in which the author is bringing all of this stuff back to our memory, recalling all that Jacob had done with respect to Esau with just these few words. The messengers go, and they have a very specific, there's specific wording that they are supposed to use that Jacob has crafted. And in particular, it's to his Lord Esau from your servant Jacob. Jacob is clearly putting himself in the position of one who is coming, making a request, a supplication, a very conciliatory mood that he's trying to establish here. Then he explains 20 years of absence in 6 words. He says, I went to Laban. He doesn't explain why he went to Laban, which is probably a good thing to omit. And then he was delayed for about 20 years, and now he's back. There are no further details. It doesn't really explain what has happened. Then he says, I have stuff, and he lists his assets. But what's interesting is he doesn't give numbers to them. He just says, I've got servants, I've got flocks, I've got all this stuff. He doesn't give numbers. And curiously, he doesn't mention that he has camels, which would have been the most valuable thing that he has. So apparently his strategy is to say, I've got lots of stuff, so that Esau understands that he's not coming begging. He's not coming to get more stuff from Esau. On the one hand, but on the other hand, he is capable of giving gifts. He's got lots of stuff that he can give. And I think that he's trying to imply that he has stuff to give. And he says that he has come that he might find favor with Esau. His mission is reconciliation. That's what he wants to achieve. So the messengers go out, and they come back, And they come back with information for Jacob. They say, Esau's coming, and he's coming with 400 men. That has to sound ominous. 400 men is the typical size of an army, so he's coming with his army. And Jacob does not know what his intentions are, but it sounds scary. Now, why is Esau coming so quickly is one of the questions. Now, Esau at this time was apparently in the process of conquering Edom, which is further to the south. And it's not clear whether Esau had heard news that Jacob was on his way. I would assume that Jacob's party, his company, would generate some news, because this is a large group that's coming. This is not just a small group of people passing through. It's a large group. It is a people. So it could have generated some news that reached Esau, and Esau had already started in this direction. Or it could have been that Esau was already in the area in his part of the conquest of Edom, that he was at the northern part of that. So it's not clear why he was so close, but he's coming, and he's coming quickly. And it says that he's coming to meet Jacob. And meet is, in Hebrew, is one of those words that it can mean to meet as in to engage in battle, or it can meet as in to meet on friendly terms. So the word is ambiguous, and Jacob is left wondering what's going to happen. So Jacob is afraid and distressed. This is obviously very ominous sounding to him. He doesn't know what Esau will do. He doesn't know what God's response will be. God protected him from Laban, but it wasn't without a certain amount of stress, nevertheless. And here comes Esau. What is going to happen? Jacob may well understand that he will survive, but will survive under what circumstances? And what will come to pass in the meantime? What will he suffer through? So there's also the question then, what should Jacob do with respect to this? How should he respond? He can't go back. He can't go back to Haran. He's got too many people to try to just flee. So he's stuck. He's going to have to face Esau. And how does he do this? So Jacob begins to think about how he should respond. And he comes up with a several part plan. Oh, with respect to this, there was an interesting quote from Luther talking about this particular passage and talking about whether it was faithlessness on the part of Jacob to take the steps that he took, coming up with a plan to try to prepare Esau for reconciliation. And Luther's comment on this was that Jacob was not being faithless. He says, man should not test God, but should use every device and means available. Jacob is just taking prudent action, wise action, with respect to Esau, and comes up with a three-part plan. The first part of it is Jacob is going to divide his party into two. He takes his possessions, his wife and his children, and divides them into two groups. And he says, if Esau attacks one and destroys it, the other one can get away. So that's what he does. That's his rationale for it. What is interesting here is Jacob's concern is the survival of the family. It's saving something for posterity. It's make sure someone survives. Then Jacob prays. And the prayer is a very eloquent prayer. It's a very meaningful prayer. He begins by addressing it to God. And what God is it? He designates it's the God of his fathers. It's the God who has made the promises to Abraham, to Isaac, and to him. It is also the same God that had told him to return back to the land. So he's praying to the God who told him to come here. And if he's going to come here, he has to face Esau. Then he comments on his unworthiness. He realizes that God has been very gracious to him over a 20-year period, well, even longer. God has been very gracious to him. There have been many kindnesses that God has paid to him. And it's not because Jacob was worthy of those kindnesses. It was rather in spite of Jacob's unworthiness that God has been kind to him and loyal to him and loyal to the promises that he had made. Then he makes his request of God. He says he fears for the lives of himself, of his wives, and his children. And he asks that God protect him from his brother. And he reminds him of the promise that God had made to protect him, and that God had said that I will be with you, I will prosper you, and that I will multiply your descendants. So again, his concern about his family going on. So the basic appeal of Jacob is to God's loyalty to his promises. You made these promises. Please now keep those promises. This is a tense situation that I am now in. One of the commentaries that I looked at was pointing out what a wonderful prayer this is rhetorically. It's meaning-packed, it's well-ordered, and it goes through the address to God, the address to God, his statement of his unworthiness, then the request that he makes of God, and it holds this up as a model of how we ought to pray. And I think that that's good. It is indeed a very well-crafted prayer. But I'm firmly convinced that God doesn't much care about well-crafted prayers. That what makes this prayer a really powerful prayer is, I think it is honest and heartfelt. And that is really the essence of a good prayer, is honesty before God. When we come before God and we're honest to him in a way that is difficult, truly honest, that is speaking from the depths of our hearts. And I think that's what Jacob is doing here, and ultimately that's what makes it powerful, not the three-point outline. Okay, the next section, verses 13 through 21. So he spent the night there. Then he selected from what he had with him a present for his brother Esau, 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milking camels and their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 male donkeys, and he delivered them into the hand of his servants, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, "Pass on before me and put a space between droves." And he commanded the one in front, saying, "When my brother Esau meets you and asks you, saying, 'To whom do you belong? And where are you going? And to whom do these animals in front of you belong?' Then you shall say, 'These belong to your servant Jacob. It is a present sent to my lord Esau. And behold, he also is behind us.'" Then he commanded also the second and the third and all those who followed the droves, saying, "After this manner you shall speak to Esau when you find him. And you shall say, 'Behold, your servant Jacob also is behind us.' For he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me. Then afterward I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. So the present passed on before him, while he himself spent that night in the camp. So the third part of his plan is to send out this gift to Esau. Jacob is, it's a huge gift. I mean, this is a very generous gift. If you add up all the animals, I think it comes out to 550 animals. And it includes some camels. He's sending out a huge gift to his brother. And he's not just sending it out in one bunch. He's got it in increments. There's one group of animals that goes, and the ones herding those animals say, this is from your servant, Jacob, and he's coming. And then the next drove comes. And so they come in these installments. And so Esau receives the first group of animals as a present, only to find that there is another group, and then only to find that there's another group. So the gift keeps growing. Clearly, what Jacob wants to do is he wants to express in deed his desire for conciliation. He wants to reconcile with his brother, and he wants this gift to go before him to prepare Esau, to make clear to Esau the spirit in which Jacob is coming. What's interesting here is there's a sense in which Jacob the schemer is at work. Once again, Jacob is doing the kind of thing that his family is wont to do, and that is to manipulate and scheme. But there's another sense in which I think this is quite different. What he's doing is, to be a good schemer, you have to know people well. It's that ability to understand what makes people tick that makes someone a good con man. But that same skill of knowing what makes people tick can also be used for another purpose, and that is to bring healing and to bring good. And in this case, he's using the same skill, but he's using it towards a different end. It's not to rip Esau off, but rather it's to prepare Esau to reconcile with him. I've often thought, with respect to my children, you'll see a strong trait in your child, and you look at that trait and you go, oh my goodness. If that trait is fully developed, we're all in trouble. But every time I have looked at one of those traits in my children, what I've realized is it all depends on how it's developed and how it's channeled. Because those traits, it seems like all of them can be rechanneled in a positive direction. It's either positive or it's negative, depending on how it's developed. But they can be channeled in a good direction. Here, Jacob is a schemer. He's a manipulator. But there's a sense in which that can be channeled in a good direction. And he can use his ability to read people and to predict how they're going to respond to things in a way that's constructive and healing. And I think that's what we see happening here. What he's really saying with these gifts is, I come in the spirit of reconciliation, and I'm earnest. I sincerely want to reconcile. Will you accept my apologies? That's what he's saying in action. Okay, now this next section, verse 22 through the end. Now he arose that same night and took his two wives and his two maids and his 11 children and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. And he took them and sent them across the stream. And he sent across whatever he had. Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak. And when he saw that he had not prevailed against him, he touched the socket of his thigh. So the socket of Jacob's thigh was dislocated while he wrestled with him. Then he said, "Let me go, for the dawn is breaking." But he said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So he said to him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." And he said, "Your name shall no longer be Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." Then Jacob asked him and said, "Please tell me your name." But he said, "Why is it that you ask my name?" And he blessed him there. So Jacob named the place Peniel, for he said, "I have seen God face to face, yet my life has been preserved." Now the sun rose upon him just as he crossed over Peniel, and he was limping on his thigh. Therefore, to this day, the sons of Israel do not eat the sinew of the hip, which is on the socket of the thigh, because he touched the socket of Jacob's thigh in the sinew of the hip. This is a bizarre scene. It's not only bizarre, it's also hard to understand. It's the way in which it is told leaves a lot of questions unanswered. It's first of all, one thing that's not clear is what time, how is the time working? I don't know if this is the same night as the night that was described in verse 13, or whether a day has passed and we're in the next night. It's not clear. But one thing that's clear is the action throughout here is nighttime action. Everything that Jacob is doing here is described as being nighttime action. What he's done is apparently it's nighttime, and Jacob is very anxious. My suspicion is he's having a tough time sleeping, very restless and not sure what to do. And apparently he decides, well, while it's already late, he's going to move his companies across this stream, the Jabbok, which is, it's, as I understand it, it's about 20 feet wide, and it's only about hip deep at the deepest. They forge, but it's in the bottom of a deep ravine. So he decides at nighttime, so kind of spur of the moment, and I think out of his restlessness and anxiety, not really knowing what to do, he sends the companies across this stream. But he ends up on the north side, not where the companies are on the south side. Now, it's possible that what is happening here is cowardice. He's just staying behind. But I don't think that's what we... In telling about this wrestling match, it seems to me that it has kind of a dreamlike quality to it. The first sentence is, "Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until daybreak." It doesn't say who the man is, where he came from, why he's wrestling with Jacob. It's just this action happens out of the blue. Well, that's the way my dreams are. There are no explanations for things. It's just action. It just starts here. And I think that we are to see this as kind of a dreamlike event that's taking place. And yet, as we get to the end of the event, it's clear, I think, that we are to take it as not a dream, but this is something that actually happened. So my understanding is it's dreamlike. It starts out very dreamlike, but it is something that actually happens to Jacob. He finds himself wrestling with this man, and they're wrestling and grappling and tussling and rolling around in the dirt. And Jacob apparently is fighting out of self-defense. I mean, I suppose if someone comes and wrestles with you, you wrestle to defend yourself. So presumably that's what's happening. But as the match goes on, and the match goes on all night, but as the match goes on, the man has not prevailed over Jacob, so he cheats. This must be the WWF. He cheats, and he throws his hip out of joint. He touches him on the hip, and his hip goes out of joint. So now he's wrestling with a great deal of pain. So the question is, do you stop wrestling at that point, or do you keep wrestling? And Jacob seems to come to the gradual realization that this is not just any man walking down the street who wrestles with him. This is God himself, or an angel. He's wrestling with God. And as he comes to that realization, the nature of the wrestling match itself begins to change. He's no longer wrestling to defend himself. Now he begins to wrestle because God has something to offer, and he wants it desperately. He wants God's blessing. And this is an opportunity for him to get God's blessing. So now the wrestling match is not self-defense, but it's to get what God has. To get what God has to offer. And the man then says, "What is your name?" And Jacob says, "My name is Jacob." Well, it's not because the man didn't know his name, but the man is going to change that name. Remember, he got the name Jacob when he was born because he was grabbing onto the heel of Esau. And Jacob means he who grabs the heel. So it's heel grabber. Well, the man changes his name from heel grabber to he who strives with God. He says, "You have striven with God and man and have prevailed." There's a Jewish commentator that I like to consult. And he says, with respect to this, "Since names in the Bible are inextricably intertwined with personality and destiny, the change here signifies a final purging of the unsavory character traits with which Yaakov," that is Jacob, "has come to be associated." So it's signifying a change in who Jacob is, from heel grabber to he who strives with God. Then Jacob turns to the man and he says, "Please tell me your name," using a polite form. "Please tell me your name." And the man wrestling with him does not tell him his name, but he instead just either blesses him, or the word, it could be translated, just says goodbye to him, just parts with him. So it's not clear whether this at the end is the blessing, or the changing of the name is where the blessing actually occurs. But he is blessed. And Jacob realizes then what has happened. He has been wrestling with God himself, in a sense. And he has been blessed by God. And at the end he says, "I have seen God face to face and yet have lived." So he names the place Peniel, which means the face of God. Only then does the sun rise and Jacob limps away, still suffering from the pain that was inflicted in the wrestling match. And then the author goes on to explain that even to this day, Israelites do not eat that particular sinew because that was the sinew that was touched by God in the wrestling match. Okay, what is this wrestling match that Jacob goes through? There's a sense in which Jacob was born a wrestler. He was born a maneuverer, a grasper, a survivor, one who manipulated and did whatever it took to make his life, to get the things that he thought he needed in order to have life. But in this wrestling match, when he discovers what the nature of the struggle is, he ceases to be that grabber, that survivor, that conniver. And what he realizes is the struggle is not a struggle against, a struggle for stuff. Rather, the struggle is the nature of the struggle of life is a struggle with God himself and coming to terms with God and reaching the point where Jacob wants whatever it is that God has to offer. That becomes of paramount value to him. And it becomes of such a value to him that even though his hip is dislocated, he continues to wrestle. He wants this desperately. And he's persistent in getting what God has to offer. We've seen this persistence before as well. And this is another one of those traits, it seems to me, which persistence can be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on how it's channeled. And here, this persistence is a very good thing. He wants what God has to offer. He values what God has to offer. I like this image because I can identify with this image. There's a sense in which it seems to me that when we're trying to understand our experience and to capture our experience in life, it's very difficult to put it into words oftentimes. Oftentimes it's more easily put into pictures. And I think this is one of those pictures that captures at least my experience in life very well. The patriarchs didn't have much theology. We have a lot more theology. There's a lot more that has been specifically revealed to us that the patriarchs did not have. But there is a sense in which we have to find God much the way that they had to find God. That even though we have extra information, every human being has to find his way to God. And life is this struggle, trying to come to terms with who we are and where we're going and what life is all about. Everyone does this wrestling match in one way or another. But for those to whom God has been gracious, we come to the understanding that this wrestling match is not with circumstances. It's not with other people. Ultimately, the wrestling match is with God himself. And the question is, what are we going to do with that? And everyone faces that, is in that wrestling match all by themselves, just as Jacob was, groping in the dark, trying to figure out what it means to come to terms with God, to make our peace with God. Others can help us in that struggle, but ultimately it's kind of a lonely process, and we're wrestling in the dark, just as Jacob was. And in order to continue the wrestling match, to keep it up, we have to value what is there for us. We have to value what God has to offer, such that even when our hip is dislocated, even when life gets really tough, that we still want what God has to offer. We are still determined and persistent and desperate even to get what God has to offer. Jesus said, "Seek and ye shall find." It's that persistence, it's that seeking. And if we persist, we will find. The same is true with this wrestling match. Wrestle and you will win, but you have to keep up the wrestling match.
You have to continue to want and to seek after that which God has to offer. And there's a lot of pain and suffering that comes along in this wrestling match that we go through in life. But we have to persist, and that's how much we are willing to persist is all dependent on how much we value what God has to offer. Thinking back to what Wes was saying about money being tight and that sort of thing, that's all dislocated hips. I mean, those are all the kinds of things, the part of the context in which we have to make the choice, do I care what God has to offer? And if I do care, then I must persist and keep striving after that which God has to give me. And ultimately, what is it that he has? What is the blessing? The blessing is life. Life the way it was meant to be lived. That what God has to offer to us is life the way it was meant to be lived. And that is an eternal gift, and it is well worth the wrestling match. It's well worth the persistence of continuing that struggle. And if we will continue that struggle in sincerity, God will indeed give us that gift. Okay, I have gone over time. So if you have questions, please write them down, and we'll deal with those next week. I will repeat my offer. If anyone wants to hear about our accreditation situation, come up here in front, and I'd be glad to talk about it and brief you. Okay, thanks.